You're listening to the Laugh Factory Podcast Network. For more shows, visit the podcast page at laughfactory.com.
It's the After Laugh, After Laugh. Welcome to the After Laugh, After Laugh, After Laugh. After Laugh, man. Go ahead and pull up a chair.
Hey guys, welcome to the After Laugh. I'm very excited about my guest today, tonight. We are sort of indirectly connected through my best friend of 20 plus years, Ginger Gonzaga. How are you?
Hi, I'm well, thank you. And shout out to Callie Norton. Haven't seen you in a while, but I love you.
Yeah, she was my roommate in New York for several years. We had a friend break up after 9/11 because she left without paying her Con Ed bill. And somehow that became like a 5-year fight. But now we're like best friends. I have all of our passwords for all of our streaming services. So I
have to pay. That's a good friend.
But yeah, so it's so good to have you. I've been sort of indirectly a fan of your work for a while.
Thank you. Thanks.
And it's such a diverse body of work.
Oh, thank you.
I think that's the best way to say it. Because a lot of people, one thing that
I try to make that, it that way.
You do a world that you bridge that a lot of people can't bridge. They don't have either the ability or whatever the connections is, you do a lot of voiceover characters and a lot of acting. Usually there's people who are there, they're either just, maybe that was back in the day, they were a voice actor or they were a legit actor.
Yeah.
And you get to kind of go back and forth between the two of them.
I wish I did a lot more voiceover. I imagine I'll do more next year. The voiceover that I do is from Friends. So it's Robot Chicken guys and Family Guy people that are like, you want to come over? And I'm like, yeah.
So that means you're buddies with Seth McFarlane?
I know Seth from Ted. Yeah.
And yeah, you did the movie Ted, which is a huge hit.
Yeah. It was so remarkable. At the time, it was the number one R-rated comedy.
That's right. Yeah. Before Wedding Crashers. Right? After
Wedding Crashers and after The Hangover.
Oh, so
it was a big deal.
So then what's the highest R-rated comedy now?
Now I don't know.
Because I thought The Hangover was the highest grossing R-rated
Hangover comedy. Maybe like it wins for sure. It's a trilogy. So
Yeah.
But I remember at the time it was bigger than maybe the first Hangover or something like that. Because I remember being like, what?
Yeah.
This thing about a bear?
And then you get the residual checks, like, all right.
You know, I was surprised by my first residual check. Me and another guy that were in it, they were like, did you get your movie residual check? And I was like, yeah. Was it like 9 times what we made when we worked?
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was really nuts.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
So another thing that I mentioned early on, I'm obsessed with someone that you've worked with.
Oh, who? Yes.
Now, I don't know if it's the team or just the one guy, but the Duplass brothers.
Aww.
Because I was a nerdy theater guy in graduate school. And they used to do...
And where did you go again?
NYU.
Yeah. Oh, you're where I was supposed to be.
Did you go to acting school?
No, but I belonged at NYU, regardless of what I was in. Like, literally, every time I'm in a meeting and there's someone my age that works and they're like a kindred spirit, I'm like, where'd you go to school? NYU? Yeah. Oh, I was supposed to be best friends with you for 12 years? Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Just...
And the Duplass brothers, I want to, I mean, there's one of those people like on my bucket list, I would love to work with them because I feel like they're so unique and creative and also rooted in real relationship issues and real psychological drama that I get. So one of the shows you did, Togetherness, was a great show. When that was canceled, I feel like that was almost like a little bit of a big thing on Twitter. People were freaking out about it.
It was such
Why was that canceled?
Industry darling. First of all, you would be great in a Duplass brothers project.
You hear that, Mark?
Mark and Jay. I love them dearly. That show was so special to me because I was, you know, everyone wanted me, I guess team-wise, like in this network cycle, you know, which I can do, but I didn't want to, and I wanted to do things like that. And then when I still remember so profoundly, like they vet you like crazy. Yeah. But then once they do, they give you so much freedom. And that's like what I'm always like chasing after. And I remember the first day on set, it was me and Amanda, Pete, and Mark. And Mark just looked at Amanda. He's like, okay, so we'll just go in there and just like make up a bunch of lines and do what we do. And I just overheard him. So I was like, what? I'm going to just do whatever I want and not ask for permission. And and it was just like, it's so egoless. What I found is like, The best situation is when the writing is already amazing and the creators are egoless slash they want you to shine and do what you do best. And I see it across the board. Like whenever it, and it's usually when the writing is amazing.
Yes.
It's when the writing's not good that they're precious about it. And you're like, you don't want my superpower to elevate this? Because I could. But okay. You don't want my brain. All right. Then what am I doing here?
You've tapped into the biggest issue I have with being an actor in the business. Because I was a theater guy. I was always a theater guy. Broadway and all stuff.
Do you think? Oh, yes, I know you did theater. Yeah, because I was listening to your other ones. Yeah.
And I've told this story in the podcast before, but one of the best directors I worked with is Tommy Kail, who directed Hamilton. He directed me a show on Broadway called Lombardi.
Wow.
And this is like, you know, the NFL is producing the show. There's a lot of money there. And my character had this... With this monologue.
Yeah.
And I remember like, Tommy, I got to have this monologue. And there's all this pressure on him.
Yeah.
They needed something else. And he went to bat for me. He kept the monologue. And months into the run, I was like, oh, this monologue is garbage. It doesn't move the story forward. But he felt like, I want to give Bill the ability to make the best of it.
Yes. And he saw like where you had a passion and where at the time you were like, this is important. And you're the person being that character this time.
For 9 months, I have to show up.
Yeah.
And then it's so funny because when you do like regional theater or smaller plays or new plays, you'll have these playwrights, you'll be in off-Broadway theater who are so convinced that their lines are so important.
It never
and if you deviate any amount, it becomes a problem.
I look at them and I'm like, you're not going to be more successful.
Yes.
If anything, just like, you know, pretend like you made up the lines that I wrote. I don't care. If I do well, if I get to do my thing, we all win. Take the credit. Like, be that guy instead of being like, my lines are so precious.
Yeah. It's one of the reasons why I kind of got out of theater was because every time I would do a play, and the last play I did, I played Rudolf Nureyev, and it was a two-person play, and I'm playing Rudolf Nureyev, who's the biggest diva ever in the history of the world. And I'm a gay Russian ballet dancer dying of AIDS. So I like lost all this weight.
Oh,
I dyed my hair.
I
got the accent. I was like so committed. And then meanwhile, the lines just aren't, they're not commensurate with what I think the character, his passion is. And so the playwright flew in from Chicago because he heard I was being difficult. He was like, you know, I don't know. I don't like to listen to actors' comments about stuff. And I just said, well, you know who does? Tommy Kail, and Hamilton's out right now. You should check it out.
Yeah.
Because it was all created by actors.
Yes, and it's collaborative. And here's the difference. You're not just an actor. You're a comic. That means you write your own shit, so you're also a writer.
Yeah.
You do have a multifaceted skill set, and it's like, it's in their best interest to see how much value you have.
Yes.
And if you do, you know, another person might not. Another person might be annoying.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah, have to have a lot of confidence if you're leading a team.
Because
I think the trouble is once you give people permission, like in your situation.
Yeah.
Hey guys, just go in there. Like, inevitably, you're going to have some people whose instincts are just shit.
Yeah. But then then that's when you're an auteur who lets them improvise, and then you just like cut it out.
Yeah. Well, that's a good thing about TV and film in general.
Yeah.
Particularly film, and I don't know how they shot like the shooting ratio for something like Togetherness was, but. For film, it's always like you at least have one take where you can do what you want.
Yeah.
Usually.
I do what I want all the time.
Has that ever become an issue in your career?
No. And it's literally the Duplasses like allowed me to be super free. And then it's almost like just like understood. I think here's the thing. I also just take things that I want to do. So I align myself with people that are going to let me do that. And then like even on Kidding, Michelle Gondry just let me do whatever I want. And when I do, I'm changing it up every time. And if he's going to give me a note, fine. But he would just tell me before scene, like, I'm not going to give you notes. And I'd be like, thanks. But obviously he knows if he needs to, then he will.
Yes.
But I like the brain challenge of making sure that he has everything in the edit without it being crafted ahead of time, you know? And I've directed one thing, and it was like with me and Jason Ritter, and we were short on time. So I told Jason ahead of time, like, you're free, but just so you know, I have three versions that I will need to get. That's the way he knows that I'm not just like being like, can you do it like this? Like, he just knows it's coming at some point.
Sure.
Where I gotta go, I need this one to be very childlike. I need this one to be sad, you know? Yeah. Or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah.
As an
actor, has it, working in that type of situation is pretty rare for a lot of actors. A lot of actors don't have that opportunity.
Yeah.
And a lot of actors probably don't even want that opportunity.
Yeah, I don't think most do. They're need it.
I'm a robot. Tell me what. Because your background, doing a little bit of research.
I'm not from Pennsylvania, like the internet says. Okay. So I'll get that one out.
But you were in UCB, right? Or Groundlings?
I did a lot of Groundlings. Yeah.
How many years?
I went up to Writer's Lab, and then I started. I had a terrible Writer's Lab, so I didn't even pass. But because I was writing for other people, I was like, nice. I didn't know you needed to like preserve yourself. I'm like, let me write for everyone but myself. That's selfish. Oh wait, no, that's how you move forward. Literally didn't get that. But I started working, and so I was working with the Groundlings on things, which was like, I did an NBC show with a lot of Groundlings. Then I did Legit with Mindy Sterling, who was my Groundlings teacher, and it was like so beautiful. That's a reward, you know.
And you've also done stand up, and I've talked to a lot of people about this fact. There's a weird division between stand up and improv.
Yeah.
It's almost like never the twain shall meet. People either pick a lane. There are people who do both, and I think that's probably the best thing to do.
I think so, yeah.
But I've always blanched at improv because my feeling is that although we're a team, at the same time, if they have an opportunity to break from the team to be a star, because humans want fucking absolute power all the time, they will do it.
Yeah.
So they'll throw anyone under the fucking bus.
Oh, they will. I know. There's always one. Yeah. Everyone's like, I was in this troupe. I'm like, who got famous?
Exactly.
What happened? Yeah.
And I also know that the Groundlings, it's like a 7-year program.
Oh, yeah.
And each year they keep cutting people. It's very fucking cutthroat, right?
It is. And if you can start working, I feel like it's like Berklee School of Music. Like they always say, like, you know, you're not successful if you graduated. Like, you're supposed to go to Berklee School of Music, and after 2 years, you're in a band.
That's
you know,
hilarious. Same thing with, like, Juilliard. I mean, I went to NYU, and the corollary was Juilliard. And, like, so many of the most famous people Robin Williams, an example.
Yeah.
Most famous people from Juilliard were all people who got kicked out or dropped out.
And probably because they were doing their own thing.
Yeah, and it's 4 years of being told, this is how iambic pentameter works.
Yeah, like, no.
Fuck that.
I know. I went to, like, one or two acting classes out here, and I was like, I hate this, you know? So I was like, I'm never going to do that. And I did a lot of improv though. So that's all I needed.
Yeah.
But
Now, did you go to Berklee School of Music?
Or
you
went I know so many people.
Did you go to Berklee?
I went to Berklee, UC Berklee. I did a year of school there in the summers when I was in high school, because they were on a semester system. So I went there when I was 15 and 16. And if you do 2 summers there, that ends up being a year because they're on the semester system. Which
My daughter's at Berklee right now.
Beautiful.
It's beautiful.
You've got such a smart family. That's like, I haven't gone back like since I was there. And it's like, I don't want to, because it's like preserved in my memory as this like romantic independent time, you know, where I was like, yeah.
So what is your sort of background that kind of got you into everything? You grew up not in Pennsylvania.
Like I'm from Modesto, California.
Modesto.
Yeah.
Which is, I've been here for so long, I still don't even know where the fuck that is. Is it like, the desert?
It's Central Valley. It's close to Sacramento, Stockton, Fresno. It's
a good
awful.
Place to be from.
No.
I mean,
it's
to
the
be
worst.
Away from, yes.
Away from, yeah. So you got to get out of the trap. But thank God, and I just did this little speech in the debate podcast earlier today, but I had a... Our city was the 5th least educated city in the nation.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And it's like, you don't even know that when you're a kid. And then all of a sudden you're listening to NPR. You're like, what? That's my town. It was also ranked the 6th most depressing. And I was like, whoa. Hang on a second. I am fucking depressed. Yeah. but weirdly, we had the number one speech coach in the nation. And that program was like so special to me. And I had humorous and terp. So I learned how to act in speech and debate.
So you were the star of the speech team.
I was.
Did you win competitions?
Oh, I won
every competition. That's great. So at that point, and now your parents, are they in the arts in any way at all? No. So when
they're in the bad parents zone that makes you do comedy.
That's so interesting. Yeah, I think that is. I mean, I love my parents and they're still around, but I look back, I'm like, yeah, it's their fucking fault.
Yeah.
Yeah, they did some fucked up things. So so you're excelling in this very cool thing, and because you've had this voice, we talked about it briefly for the podcast. You have this like big rich voice and this little pretty girl body. Which that cognitive distance I feel is like the key to so much success in Hollywood. Like you look on a sitcom, you see this like little skinny girl, like she sounds like a sailor. You're like,
yeah,
that's you're so like, fucking cool.
That's the recipe. Well, especially like I feel like in multicam, whenever I'm dating someone and they're annoying me I'll be like, stop being the multicam husband. And it like literally it cuts through and they're like, oh yeah, I don't want to be that.
But for what does that mean, the multicam husband?
For so I feel like every multicam, it's like the small, pretty wife that has a lower voice who's the smart one.
Yes.
You know what I mean? And her dumb husband yes. who's just, you know, bumbling around. And so anytime I've like dated someone and they think it's cute to be stupid in some area, I'll be like, no. Don't be the sitcom husband, because that makes me the, you know, sitcom wife, and I don't want to be that. Yeah.
Now, do you think that is a trope that is still working today? Because that's definitely 80s, 90s was the whole thing.
I think it's still there. Yeah. I don't know that it's, I mean, I don't know what multicams are out there right now.
And there's also a very funny trope in these multicam sitcoms that Daniel Tosh used to do, but I loved, where there's this joke that it's always the guy who's like, hey, are we going to get to have sex later? And she's like, oh, you rascal.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Like, away.
Yeah.
And I'm like, wait, when I'm in relationships, women are pretty fucking horny.
Yeah.
Usually they're hornier than most men.
Yeah.
Usually I'm like, I'm tired. They're like, what? I got needs, motherfucker.
Yeah.
So,
no, that's like a weird, like, religious for middle America, yeah, like, shame right? surrounding sex.
Because we are founded on a Puritan country, and people forget that. We do have these weird bullshit Puritan values that are always put out in the media.
I know. I hate it. And I love all of our sex workers. And I love, that's why I love Bill Maher so much. I love Bill Maher as a friend and a person. But I'm just like, thank you for not having any shame surrounding sex. Because if you did, he would have a malignant element to him in his, you know, with his personality. And it's just like, ugh, it's so refreshing.
Yeah, he definitely is a unique voice in the comedy world, because he's sort of like, he doesn't sort of follow all of the like the leftist, for lack of a better word, tropes and like the talking points he has to follow. He's very anti-woke.
Yeah.
So a lot of people are like, he's a fucking Republican. He's a closet Republican. I'm like, no, he's not.
He's not. Well, and what I love about Bill is Bill will let me like dig into him about those things, and he will chat with me on it, and in a way I don't think, I feel like maybe not a lot of women have done, or at least like my, I don't know, I sat with him at Chateau Marmont like before the pandemic, and I just was like, tell me about this, because I've never understood like why guys do this, and but you know, like people like you, like you're brilliant, why don't you have a wife that's brilliant, why don't you, and he doesn't date a lot of brilliant women, but he's curious enough about, you know, humans and himself to like try to have those chats.
And he also doesn't seem like he wants to be a guy who lives low integrity. He doesn't want to be in a relationship and be a cheat.
He doesn't.
And goof around. Yeah. He wants to be a good guy.
Yeah. So
which means he's going to be single until he dies, probably.
Yeah. I think he would say that. Yes. Yeah. But I adore him for, especially
have
for.
Have you been on his show?
No, I want to do it. I gotta bug him somehow. Soon, just because I do miss, like, I miss the brain. I miss the brain.
Yeah, well, I guess for his show right now, you have to have a distinct political point of view that you're coming on with.
I don't have anything to offer right now until, I mean, I did in 2016, and then I took a break because I was like, I was warning all of you. I saw what was happening.
Yeah, you would be the person that comes in, like, halfway through the show from the side and sits there and just does color commentary and makes fun of shit.
Yeah,
I would. And the other the pundits are over there just kind of like, what did she say?
What is she doing? Yeah. I want to do it. Yeah, at some point when I
for
have
your next big show, which may be coming up soon.
Yeah.
So going back to Modesto, so you're in Modesto.
Yeah.
You're wanting to kill yourself.
Yes.
Terrible thing.
Fact.
Your parents are fucked up. We don't have to talk about that. You're doing the speech thing. You're thriving. There's always a point, I feel, for people who get into arts, where somebody important, like a mentor, goes, you know, this is something you should do.
Ugh, I did not have that.
You didn't even have that.
No, and it's so
how did you jump from there to get into the business?
It's so funny when people, like, I have a friend, Phil America, who's a very famous artist, and he was like, who's your mentor? And I was like, what are you talking about? I just had, like, that need, you know, like, the need and the, I was definitely, like, the black sheep. I knew I needed to get out of Modesto. I mean, I didn't go to college for what I wanted to do.
What did you go to college for?
Like international relations.
So you're a smart person. I mean, you took a year at Berkeley when you were 15.
Yes, but what sucked is I didn't get to go to Berkeley because my mom, I found out, I was, you know, I was a speech and debate champion and I was like ranked nationally and, you know, but my town was also very white and also very racist. And come my junior year, like my teachers would, like I would turn in a, I would turn in a document that was supposed to be 10 pages. And I was just out of Berkeley, so I would turn in like something 25 pages because yeah. I loved it and I was crazy. And then they would be like, oh, you got 108% on this. Come see me after class. And I'd be like, I'm the best. And they and then they would be like, oh, this is worth like 108%. And I'd be like, thank you. And then they'd be like, but we know you copied off your boyfriend who's at Princeton now. And I would be like,
hilarious.
Yeah. And so then I would be like, you're so like racist, but it hurt me so
or
much.
Or sexist or both.
Yeah, or anything. I assumed it was racism. I also didn't understand. I would be like, I literally win every weekend in spontaneous speaking related to international relations that you have to cite all of these things. I win in debate. Like, you can't fake any of this. Like, yeah. You can't fake these things. And it just kept happening and happening. And I got really terrible grades. And my senior year, I was getting bad grades. And then finally, my senior year, my English teacher, who I think was gay and felt like a little outside also, and yeah. I'd had him a couple years in a row, he was like, I got like a 5 or whatever on my AP test, so he knew like I couldn't have faked it, and he was like, hey, I'm not supposed to tell you this, but like, here, this is from your mom. And my mom was an educator, and she had written a letter to this school telling them that I had tested as mentally retarded and that she was a Christian woman and she knew that I was stealing essays off the internet and that I was, you know, just, I had delusions of grandeur. So I was in all these AP classes. Meanwhile, my side hustle was I was cheating. And she's so religious and so honest that she just needs to tell everyone. So I couldn't get into a school that I deserved to go to. And I,
so how, she your even mom's took, letter, she didn't send it to Berkeley.
No, she sent it to my teachers.
Guidance counselors and shit.
All my teachers, junior and senior. But I don't understand. Where's their critical thinking? Because I'm like, hello, I go every weekend, I come home with a trophy. Like, yeah. I literally am like increasing the value of this piece of shit school.
Yeah.
You know?
And why do you think your mom did that?
Well, because she's crazy.
Okay, yeah. But so also, there's a lot of crazy people, but yeah. In their head, they have a justification for
yeah,
why they
well,
do what they do.
Yeah, well, a personality disorder. Yeah. But also, you know, like just...
Was it jealousy or yeah, she didn't want you to succeed and get away from her? She wanted you to stay around
that,
the best,
it's
though?
Like the possessive trap. It's, you know, if they're narcissists or sociopaths, narcissists and sociopaths, when they have 3 children, it's textbook that they have.
Are you the youngest or...
I'm the middle.
The middle,
but
okay.
If they have 3 kids, there's one that they neglect, the golden child, and then there's the scapegoated child, and the scapegoated child is always the most empathetic and the biggest truth telling and doesn't tolerate the family system. So yeah. I'm always the one being like, this is fucked up, blah blah blah, and I would call it out. Also, I would call it out in a way that she could never argue with me because I was a debate person. So she just hated me.
Yeah.
And just
so needed, your teenage years, your mother hated you.
Yeah, well, my mom hated me since I was like 6. Basically, I took an IQ test when I was 6, and then my mom, also being weirdly religious and unwell, decided that I was going to use my intelligence for evil, and I was like the good son. And she had this narrative for herself.
Real quick, Good Son, movie with Macaulay Culkin.
Yeah.
Underrated film. He's a terrible actor, but a good film.
It's creepy. Yeah.
Creepy as fuck, yeah.
Yeah. And so, and she would, you know, they character assassinate.
And so where was your father when this was going on? Is it something that you could confide in him about? Or
not really, because he didn't really work in, he worked in San Francisco during the week. He's also from a third world country.
Yeah.
And he's also from a third world country where you just respect your parents.
And your background is what again?
My dad's Filipino. And my mom's like Dutch and French and yeah, English.
So, because
yeah.
Ginger Gonzaga is like a collision of 2 different cultures. So Gonzaga
yeah,
is
Gonzaga is like the Spanish part of the Philippines. Yeah.
And Ginger is?
Ginger is the flower that was outside of the window in the Philippines when my parents conceived me. And I I guess, thank goodness, because I like my name, but I didn't need to know that story. Yeah.
That's actually a really cool story,
so
though.
Weird.
Yeah. So, you finished school, poor grades.
Yeah, well, I couldn't get into a college that I belonged to.
So this must be like a real, and early on in your life, that's kind of a heart of darkness moment where you go, shit, I have a shitty mom who's not, my dad's kind of a little bit absent.
Yeah.
And you have to make a big decision. So where do you go from there?
Well, I only got in, I applied to everywhere I wanted to go. Yeah. And I conveniently only got into UC Santa Barbara, where my mom went on a gymnastics scholarship, which means I'm not eclipsing her. So I could have gotten in other schools. I would never know.
Yeah. Yeah. But, and by the way, let me tell you, I went to Princeton.
Yeah.
So many fucking idiots to Princeton.
What year did you go there? I wonder if you're there with my ex from high school.
I graduated in the 90s, in the late 90s.
So you would have been like a senior when he went as like a friend. He went in like 2000.
2000. Yeah, yeah. I graduated by then.
A lot of interesting characters there.
But it's a lot of legacy, a lot of money.
Yeah, a lot of legacy.
It's one of those schools you go to the first 6 months, you're like, I can't believe I got in.
But where were you from?
I was from White Trash, Virginia.
So you're like Dimitri Martin. He's like from Jersey somewhere and like gets in. Yeah.
Yeah. And
good on you. You're the real deal.
So yeah. And I always joke that I was the African-American quota because my school is a mostly black high school that historically had been shunned by all the Ivy Leagues.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
my
yeah.
English teacher wrote an article about my family because both my brothers, two older brothers, I'm the youngest, they're super, super brilliant, and they didn't get into a lot of Ivy League schools.
Oh, yeah.
They got Harvard, Yale, and Princeton all said no. And so he goes, this is fucking bullshit. I mean, in more eloquent terms, because here we have these valedictorians who aren't getting perfect SATs. And
oh my
it shows like some sort of classism, racism, and then next year I got in. So, and I was not nearly as smart as my fucking
brothers. Well, you still probably deserve to go.
But anyway, the first 6 months, I'm like, oh my God, how again? The next 3.5 years, like, how the fuck did they get in? How did she get in?
I know. I remember like my high school ex telling me like about some people and meeting them and just being like, what? Like, why are you?
Yeah, because they wrote Crew, wherever it is.
Crew, I know, that was always my joke. I was like, I'm going to be the coxswain, and I'm going to like get in a, be the little tiny person yelling at everybody. And all.
So you go to Santa Barbara, and you're majoring in international relations?
Yeah. International relations. Yeah, and Chinese was my minor. All things
so you can speak Chinese?
I used to be able to speak Chinese.
Oh, that's so cool.
I can't anymore.
Hey, they're about to take over.
I know, I got to like start boning up. I know. I can say the things that they want, like, Hongbao de shu, si zui hao de shu, which is, the communist book is the best book.
That's hilarious.
Yeah.
So I imagine they also have a theater program there that you were getting involved in.
No, not at all. I just didn't like anything about that school. I didn't like the people. I didn't like the party. I didn't like the beach. I didn't like the vibe. Nothing. I didn't like what I was doing.
Yeah.
And even, you know, right before I graduated, like I went and saw a Groundlings show and then I auditioned for the Groundlings and I got in. And then I was like, well, maybe I will stay. Like, let me go see what this improv troupe is all about at UCB. And I was, or yeah, UC Santa Barbara. And it was like pathetic. So I was like, no, I'm just going to go move to LA with the good people.
But you did graduate 4 years?
Yeah. Oh, in three. But I had already done, you know.
But I'm a genius. So the only thing we
I could have graduated earlier if I hadn't taken the stupid language. Yeah.
So then you moved to LA.
Then I moved to LA by myself. And, you know, I had
friends. Any support from the parents at all? Nothing?
No.
They're like, good luck.
Yeah, no, I was like, yeah, and I wouldn't have gone. I wouldn't have gone home or anything. I divorced myself. Yeah. So, but then, you know, like, none of my friends, I mean, I wasn't really, I had a lot of friends, but I wasn't really close with people in college. I was also just like swimming in PTSD from my, you know, childhood there.
Sure.
And but being very active, at least getting a lot of stuff done. But then, and then I moved to LA and I was like doing the Groundlings and but like I didn't know anyone here.
Yeah.
It's so weird. Your first year.
Yeah. Your first year.
Yeah.
That's people. I feel like the way you know people when you move to LA, for if you're a comic, it's the comedy scene, the world, and you think like that is the world.
Yeah.
Until you realize,
and then you're
what
like,
a teeny microcosm.
Yeah, I'm like,
it is,
why are all these people douchebags? Yeah.
Like, most people don't give a shit about the fucking Laugh Factory.
And yeah,
like,
I know.
I think it's everything.
Me too. That was like me and the improv. I was like, yeah.
But Groundlings has that thing of like, well, you know, SNL, this is where they plucked from.
Yeah.
So when Groundlings kind of, you get to a certain point, that sort of tapers off or doesn't go to full fruition.
Yeah, but I was also dating a sociopath at the time and like didn't have full capacity of my brain.
Okay, you're dating a sociopath. I'm assuming another actor?
No,
comic.
He was a loser, first and foremost.
If you're going to be a sociopath, be a successful sociopath. Just, that's the moral of the story.
Yeah, he's a successful sociopath. Well, he's successful in his bullshit. But yeah, he like... he wrote for South Park. That's not true. Nobody writes for South Park except for Trey.
Yes.
You know, he has minions. He was a PA, basically.
Yeah.
But then he had quit, and he was awful. You know, his parents died. I paid for their funerals, and then a year later, I found out they weren't dead, that type of thing.
That, by the way, that is one of the craziest sentences I've heard in a long time.
Do you want them? I just did a show the other day where I give it in a fast thing. I go,
give it.
I did a show at the Groundlings where someone's like, are you okay? And I talked about this part. And my little riff was, yes, except I just got out of the relationship with a sociopath and his parents died. And he convinced me to take out a loan to pay for his parents' funeral. And a year later, I found out they weren't dead. Oh, girl, it fucked me up. But don't worry. He got me a therapist. The first therapist I'd ever had in my entire life. And I spoke to this therapist via email and on the phone. But wouldn't you know it, it was a catfish kind of situation. And it was actually him and his friends manipulating my brain with fake psychotherapy so that they could continue to deplete my bank account and steal my writing so that he could get a job on the Mad TV. But the good thing is, there was some positive that came out of it. I learned how to cook iodine-free food, you know, because he told me he had thyroid cancer. But really, his extreme weight loss was from a two-week juice cleanse he went on before he went to got married to go get married, which I also didn't know about. Long story short, I'm homeless.
Oh, and so that, my yeah, that's God. That is crazy. Now, when you look at a situation like that, you go... Because I'm always one of these people, when I get in fucked up situations, and I've been in a few, I go, what did I do? What did my personality, and we spoke briefly, you're kind of an empath,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, to a fault. I have a toxic level of empathy.
So
toxic to me.
So empathy and intuition can sometimes, they're battling with each other, right?
Yes, but I have a lot of both.
Yeah, so your intuition failed at this point, obviously.
My intuition failed because for a lot of reasons, but also as a person, my intuition, I would ignore my intuition because I was gaslit as a child so much.
Yeah.
So I was always right. I always knew what the truth was. I always knew, you know, I could pick up on everything and my mom would deny it. Plus my reality had already been altered in school.
Yeah.
You know, I'm living in like where white is black and black is white.
Yeah.
For so long and not recovering from that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But I didn't even like this person. You know, it was just truly that like subconscious, like, you're my mom. And I recreated it many years later. But
yeah, you can fix your relationship with your mom indirectly by helping this guy.
Yeah, if I fix you, then my mom is never, I don't have, that never happened to me or something. But also just like normalizing so much neglect.
Yeah.
And normalizing so much abuse. And I had so much psychological abuse from my mom. So I wasn't hip to a lot of this.
Sure.
And I'm foolishly... honest, and I really just didn't believe that people lied.
I 100% agree with you.
Yeah.
Even now, and I mean, perfect example is, like I said, I have a daughter.
Yeah.
I had a manager, a female manager, who was like, I'm going to make you a big star. You're so fucking talented. She was representing Thomas Jane, Matt LeBlanc.
Oh, yeah.
I think Rachel True, maybe like two other people.
Oh, yeah.
And they were all like, great. And
yeah.
I was brand new out of high school.
Yeah.
At high school, out of grad school. And so I believed her. And at one point, she's like, you know, I don't want to rep you. I want to fuck you. And I was like,
I could have called that.
And I was like,
also,
what?
Ew. But I say that, and I have male managers that want to sleep with me. You got to navigate it.
So I was like, she'd flown me to LA to like introduce me to people and take meetings. And she'd do the slap and tickle thing where she'd set up a meeting. She had to go. I was like, it went okay. I don't know if my audition was, what, are you a choke artist? Are you one of these people who like has potential, but you're a fucking choke artist?
Ew.
You can't do anything.
I'm manager.
No, mom, don't yell at me. She's, no, it's okay. I just want to make sure. I'm just taking care of you.
Oh,
you know,
she's
so it's
like a, just. Oh, she's
it was
like
crazy.
Most of the men that I've known in
so,
the industry.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, also had a very low voice, and she and then she came to New York to try to like suss out if we could work together, and we got in a big fight, and. In my weird 23-year-old brain, wherever the fuck it was, I was like, this is hot. And we ended up having sex.
Yeah, yeah.
One night stand.
Yeah.
Afterwards, I was like, don't call me again. And then 2 years later, I met my daughter.
Oh, that was your manager, was your daughter's. Mm-hmm. And didn't she take her away for a bit?
Yeah, there's a whole long story. As a matter of fact, it's so ironic because she.
I mean.
My daughter is so amazing. She's so cool. She's at Berkeley and we're really cool. And I've had to kind of, and look, I would never speak ill of the mother to my daughter. I saw a dad with his daughter on the phone in New York one time, a payphone, back when payphones were a thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's like, I'm not going to fucking be here. And I'm like, I'm never going to be that guy.
Yeah.
So, but I did have to tell my daughter, who was going through a really rough time, like, you can love your mom from afar.
You know, it's really triggering for people when it's less so now, but I've just seen in my entire life, if I say that I don't talk to my mom, people like it's so uncomfortable for people. A, sometimes it's because they love their mom. Sometimes it's because they didn't know they had an option. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And like, they're so enmeshed with their parent. And it makes you look like you're this monster. But some people have like the mom from Precious, you know, or the mom from the Munchausen by proxy. You know, like, and it is self-preservation to do that. And I actually don't, I wouldn't go out there and like, for certain people with certain moms, I wouldn't be like, yeah, you need to forgive that person because that can actually put you in danger.
Yeah.
You know, because certain personality disorders are textbook and untreatable.
Yes.
So like, you need to honor like, you know.
Yeah. So I'm in a tough, even now, even though my daughter is above 18, she's an adult, like it's still how to negotiate because I don't want her mother to get back into her life, drain all of her money. Because every time I send her money, it would just my daughter's like, I don't have any money to eat. I'm like, I just sent you $1,000. And I'm like, where did it go? And this I found out like, she would have to give it to her mom.
Textbook.
So the point is, back to believing everyone, when the manager said, I'm infertile, I can't get pregnant. There was no part of my brain at 23, whatever, that was like,
ooh,
is she lying to me because she's 37 and looking to get knocked up? I was like, why would she
and
lie?
And she's like, you got a good brain. Let me have a kid with you.
Yeah, she's like, Princeton 60. Okay.
Yeah.
And then.
Wow, that is like so predatory. It's crazy.
Yes. Yeah. So yeah, I'm the same way. Whenever people lie about, I always like, why would, I understand the concept as a male who wants to please mom, a concept of lying not to get in trouble.
Yeah.
But the fact that you would lie to deliberately manipulate someone.
Oh, that's like a whole,
thing I just don't understand.
Yeah.
So this guy who did that, like, was there ever any comeuppance with that? Is he still around?
No, I mean, the way that it all went down is like, he had stolen my writing to get a job on Mad TV.
He got the job on Mad TV? Uh-huh.
They were all like, but he also would drop Trey Parker's name all the time. And then they were like, this guy's not right. The day after I found out that his parents were alive, I weirdly had Trey Parker's email. I didn't know him. And I was like, hi, you don't know me. I dated this guy. His parents aren't dead. Like, I just like, I don't know what's real, like, blah, blah, blah. But that same day that I emailed Trey, people from Mad TV had contacted Trey to be like, what's up with this guy that's always dropping your name? And Trey hated him. They went to high school with him and they're like, they'd always hated him. And then he crept into town one time, like begging to be a PA. And he was like their little bitch, you know?
Yeah.
So then I met like all these important people like Trey and people who wrote Team America and victims from Mad TV who were not really victims. Like they weren't going to be homeless next, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And like, you know, I was like, just like, trying to keep it chill, trying to cover up how fucked up I was. And Trey at the time was like, he had me over to his house and then was like vetting me to like see what my deal was. And then he was like, oh yeah, like, okay, you're a good kid. Like, I'm going to treat you like my little sister. And it like meant so much to me because I was like just in so much danger, you know? And, but then.
What do you mean you're in so much danger?
I was, because this guy, Toby Morton, Google, but like he was like, he didn't know that I knew everything and he was trying to like live with me. So, you know, and he's crazy. Like, yeah. I mean, I was talking to 12 fake people in the entire relationship.
Jesus.
One of which was a therapist. And it got to a point where they were even calling me on the phone. So, and he did, he took all of my money. And so, you know, it was just really scary. And I felt so comforted by Trey, just knowing that I was like believed and knowing that he was a person that could give me answers. But then Trey stopped talking to me, like just like ghosted me one day. And I get it because like he didn't know me and we didn't know who all was involved in this.
Sure.
I found out that I was like, a lot of the money that I gave him was going towards his rent for him and his wife. Was she involved in this? I told her. Trey told me that she was married and I was like, should I call her and let her know? So I did, but she could have been in on it. I don't really know if she was the victim or if she was like his accomplice. I'll never know.
Wow.
And then he went and conned a bunch of people in Ireland and then he went and conned a bunch of people. I don't know if you know the Grolix guys. They have friends.
The what guys?
The Grolix guys comics. They're like a Colorado comics and they're from Colorado. So they had like rich friends that Toby had manipulated. He's just like, this is how he exists.
Yeah. And so I guess you've never worked with, because other than the Duplass brothers, Trey Parker, I mean, Jesus Christ, he's also one of my fucking heroes.
He's amazing. Yeah. I mean, so funny and so fast. I wish that I could see him now, you know, but it was such a weird way to be introduced to him. And I had no career at all. And I was really just like trying to keep it together when I was with him because I was like not well. Like I think the day that I found out that his parents were alive, I called some number that was in his phone and his dad's name was Howard Morton and he literally answered the phone, "This is Howard Morton." And I know I blacked out and I don't know how many days that was. You know?
Wow.
I don't know what happened.
And you're how old at this point?
I was like 21.
21. 21, 22. Oh God, yeah.
Yeah.
It's like, ugh, God, to learn that. And so this happens, another big sort of blow.
Yeah.
Where do you go from there? Like, because obviously, like, you have a great career. I mean, you've made it, kid.
Thanks.
So that's a big step from being lost at the behest of some sociopath.
Yeah.
Taking your money.
Yeah.
What were the steps where you were able to kind of like regalvanize yourself and get back into like a scene? It was just like, you had agents, you had like, how did you make the next step?
Yeah. I mean, I think at the time I had maybe like a commercial agent. I don't know. Right after that, I mean, I was like literally homeless for like a month. And then but also like paying for Groundlings classes. You know what I mean? It's like
LA homeless.
Yeah. LA homeless. Like really, you like live in your car, you're paying for Groundlings classes.
You were living in your car.
Yeah. Well, first I lived in, so I had to move out of my apartment and the lady whose apartment I was renting, she like never followed up on it. She was just like rich and she never cared.
Yeah.
So I had moved out of the apartment, but I was like sleeping in the closet for a while. Like, and my hustle, like this is such a like combination of so many words. Like my hustle was like, okay, I'm going to sleep in the closet. And if she comes, I'll hear her and I'll leave my LSAT books here. And so my plan was, so I taught LSAT prep in college. So that's what I had. I had a blanket and a pillow and LSAT prep books so that if she came, I could be like, oh, I forgot the LSAT prep books. I would just like wake up and be like, oh, I forgot a pillow, a blanket and my LSAT prep books. I guess so I would look like a decent human, like, know. And then I was like waitressing. I did a lot of bottle service, but I also started singing at this club.
And this is in LA still.
Yeah, yeah. I started singing at this place, and that was a really magical time for me. That's how I know Callie.
And you started singing. Yeah, where was?
So I started singing at the Green Door. I was waitressing there, and
the
then Green Door. I would sing.
And Callie was a server at the time.
Yeah, she was like our door person. Yeah,
she's door person. Okay.
Yeah, and it was this like really magical experience where like Prince would sit in and
listen to you sing.
I think he was there once when I sang. He liked me, I think, because I looked like Apollonia. But Prince did a private concert for us, and we had all these wonderful musicians like Kamasi Washington and people who are all amazing now. And
so that's amazing opportunity and great place to meet people. I didn't know that you were also a singer.
Well, I definitely like could have taken that and ran with it, but I didn't, and it's like a really big regret of mine.
Yeah,
but yeah, it was happening so fast, I couldn't believe it. Mm-hmm. I, you know, think I had like a producer in like 2 days who was very famous, but I had so much shame. Because I always looked really dope at work. I love fashion, and it was a very like fancy place, and I always
Green
looked
Door.
Like a very specific way. But no one knew that I like had no money. You know what I mean?
I got it. Exactly.
And so like producer would be like, come over to my house in Malibu and like let's make an album, and here's Macy Gray, go meet her. And I would just be like, oh, they have no idea that I'm like barely functioning.
And you're living in the closet at this point.
Yeah, I live in a closet, but I got a dope outfit when I sing, you know, and.
Wow, that's fascinating.
But I think I also had the balls to sing with like such famous people, or, you know, and around such famous people, because I just was rock bottom.
And you had nothing, literally
like,
nothing to lose.
Who fucking cares? Literally, like this person has destroyed everything that is me, so what do I care?
Yeah,
you know? And it
was it jazz standards or what was the music?
The guy who ran the night was this musician, Darren Johnson, who was Miles Davis's last pianist, and he's like a genius. And we did like I did a lot of like Feist covers, but we do everything in a really weird way because everyone was like pretentious. These are like the best musicians ever. That's why Prince would perform there. Prince had this security guard Raul, and Raul would come and sniff out the club and like make sure the musicians were up to Prince's par.
Yeah.
And then we'd see Raul and we'd be like, oh, dope, Prince is gonna come in, and then he would. Yeah.
Oh my god. Yeah, I used to hear the legendary stories about Prince performing private shows in LA. I was like, I want to go. I can't believe I'm not being invited. How can I get invited to a Prince private show?
The most magical moment for me was Prince. That club was really small. It was really beautiful, though. And Prince did like a rehearsal just with himself and his band a couple hours before. And I was there. So it was just me sitting at a piano. And my friend Mark, who's now so many years sober, who also used to run the place, like, he remembers this. So it's like, when he talks about it, it makes me like want to cry. But it was just like, I sat at the piano and I just watched Prince tell all of his musicians how to play their instruments.
Wow.
Yeah, it was cool. He'd be like, and he'd go up to the drums, he'd be like this. And then he'd go, and it's like, he knows.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah.
So the music stuff, so you're saying that it was something you could have run with, but you didn't because you had guilt. Was there an opportunity like right in your doorstep that you were like, I'm not going to take this. It's too much.
There were so many. It was insane. It was like, I literally was like, I'm going to sing and I want these people to be my producers. And literally 3 weeks later, I was singing and all of those producers were at the club. But I had a thing which I only got to the bottom of really recently in trauma therapy. And I had this for a lot of many, many years is like I severely disassociate when I get compliments. Or if an opportunity is coming my way. So I would, some of them I was conscious of, and I would make plans with like Macy Gray's producer and stuff like that. But like people would come up to me, articulate that they wanted to work with me, and I would really like go blank and I wouldn't respond. Like, and then like at the end of the night, I'd be like, what happened? Someone said something to me and blah, 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 like I forget like this one thing, you know?
Yeah.
And I wouldn't remember it. And so I think people thought I was really weird. Yeah. And I had it with writing too. It's because my mom would like, you know, retaliate if I had success or was complimented.
Yeah, for sure.
So literally until last year, I associated compliments with an attack.
Wow. That's interesting. Yeah. I think that a lot of artists in general, it's hard to take a compliment.
Sure.
Because we have so many issues with self-worth.
Yeah.
But that's like next level.
Yeah, I really would be like, why are they attacking me? Why are these people trying to give me
a lot of success? You have a great go fuck yourself.
Yeah.
So with the music, so then the Green Door, sort of that episode ended, just sort of.
Yeah, that was just like 6 months of like awesomeness for all of us. But I was doing comedy as well at the time. And I thought
that you did stand up. Do you remember some of your jokes? Do you remember the first time you went on stage?
Maybe. I used to work out at like Bruco.
Uh-huh. You know? In Westwood, yeah.
Yeah. I remember I had to open for Jeff Dunham once, which was awful, but that was the first time I got paid.
Where was this?
At the Brea Improv. I remember being like, I'm going to make $50.
Yeah.
I'm getting paid.
Oh, the first time I get paid as a comic is a huge
it's
deal.
It's so, yeah. And I.
Why was it awful opening for him?
Well, I didn't know who he was. My manager was like, go open for Jeff Dunham. You have to have clean jokes. And then I remember going to Jeff and being like, can I do my rape joke? And he was like, no.
What?
And I was like, no, okay. And then I like got up there and then I was like, oh, this is not my audience. And there were like three hipsters, like three like older children of like parents who brought them.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, my audience is these three people in the back. Yeah. Yeah. It was like such an odd experience. I don't know why anyone would have thought like, oh, go have her open for Jeff Dunham. I don't even remember. I think I did a lot of, I don't know.
Yeah.
Sometimes it was political. Sometimes, I remember it. Yeah.
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 So, and you did stand up for about how long? Like 2-3 years more?
I did it maybe for like 2 years. I didn't need it after a while. I would crave it when I would be like on a show and not allowed to improvise.
Sure.
And I wanted to be like, I want to show people I can write and this is my brain.
Yeah, exactly.
And then sometimes like over the years I would go back and dabble with it and do it in character a lot. I was also like doing a lot of hidden camera, like Sacha Baron Cohen-y stuff at the time.
Oh, you were for a show or yourself?
I was like gonna pitch a show and I was doing, like I auditioned for American Idol in character and I...
Well, you auditioned for American Idol in character?
Yeah, yeah.
What was the character?
And I got it, a lot of it filmed. I got an interview filmed. It was like this character that was like really on the spectrum and I could get, she's so sweet, this character Leslie that I did, and I could get away with murder as her. I did like tea party rallies. I did... Because I was doing it over several years. But then I'm such an idiot that I was like, no one can see like these things that I've made. Like, otherwise they'll know that it's me. Or I don't know. I was like hiding it. I had like such amazing tape.
Yeah.
And then also like I would like choose the wrong. I was always choosing like, you know, if I had really good management opportunities, I would be like, who's the most neglectful? Oh, that one, you know? And then I would go to like the neglectful manager and they would be like, this is dangerous. And I'd be like, or is it like brave and there aren't other women doing it and we could sell this? Yeah.
So you have that stuff on tape right now?
Yeah, I don't have the Tea Party rally one anymore. I really mourn that because was so expensive and I went to so many different rallies in Solvang. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I had the American Idol one. I did this like Filipino character.
American Idol, I want to get to that real quick. So, because I've talked to a lot of people who did American Idol and there's obviously a lot of different steps. Did you get in front
front
of the group? No.
Yeah, that would have been, I mean, first of all, you're in line for 8 hours. So I was already in character for 8 hours just like being weird. And then.
Can you do a little bit of the character?
Leslie, Leslie would be like, oh God, what would she say? I don't know. She's just really like, you know, she liked comedy. Like, oh, this would be something she'd say. What's the most important thing about comedy?
What?
Timing.
Yeah, exactly.
But like do it wrong. I used to bomb intentionally as her doing stand up.
Yeah.
But then I would bomb and people would comfort me afterwards and they didn't know I was filming and I got exactly what I wanted. So, you know, even though I would break character afterwards, I would still be in this ugly outfit. And people would be like, oh, like, good for you. And like, whatever. I'd be like,
that's
oh.
So funny.
Yeah.
It's so funny you said that too, because I do that. I still do that. I still go up on character a lot. Yeah. Sometimes at the Laugh Factory, they'll have a midnight show.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I'm not going to go out there and do my, and go, hey guys, try to do my A, like, headlining set.
Yeah.
So I have like, I have a few different characters. One character is, he's Russian. He's very serious.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He's depressing and he is a, he talks about how his babushka don't love him. And
I feel like I might have seen this at some point in my
life.
And
they just go like very deadpan. And I just try to like shoehorn some of my old jokes into the character.
Yeah.
But people didn't know that I was putting on
Yeah, because you're committing. Yeah.
And then I would just do like this. I'm from like, I do like a Southern guy. Just like, hey man, you know, everyone's up here like vote for, they don't understand Trump, man. He's a genius. You know, I would just do like a complete like red state set.
Yeah.
And then I'll do like a guy from Scotland. And I'll do
And
then one time I did a guy from India. I'm going to be from India. And people were like, white people are like, there are white people in India. I can't do the accent now.
That's
funny
to commit to that.
But at one point,
that's hilarious.
I did the Russian so much that this is how long ago it was.
A lot of this is forever ago.
This is like 2006 maybe.
Yeah.
I had a pitch meeting with AOL.
I literally like almost sold a pitch to AOL and then the next day they stopped existing. Yeah, and I was exactly. like, what? Yeah.
And the pitch was basically, and this is before the movie Borat.
Yeah.
Like kind of right before, but I said, I want to be this Russian guy who's a comic illegally in America. And I show up and I go up there and I'm drinking vodka and I'm sad and depressed and I just want to make friends.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I got broken up with.
Leslie wanted to make friends.
And,
that was her biggest
thing. Then you follow me around because you're doing a documentary about me and then I meet people.
Yeah.
And I hang out with them.
Yeah.
Because it was always easy, particularly back then, just to get a group of people from the show and go hang out. We'd go to the club. And I'd be this Russian guy.
Oh, that's a smart
They want to take care of me. And they would say, and at some point, like something happens, like my wife from Russia shows up. Or
IMS
shows up. It becomes this big dramatic event and they have to like decide what to do. It'll be, like I was like, that something like that would never work. And then Borat came out.
I know.
Later.
I hate all these fear-based people that don't want the new shit.
Yeah.
That's so funny. My stuff was like actually discovered on YouTube from this place called 360, and basically it was like UTA when they made they made like a production company and this guy like found me and then so he got in touch with me because I was with Levity at the time I think and my character is like I look completely different than my characters and then I showed up pretty and then he wanted to date and then the show couldn't exist like he was gonna buy it and then I remember he wanted me to like go to dinner or something and I didn't. And then I was like, I just knew. I was like,
oh God.
But if I had just been the ugly girl who was funny, I would have been the next Sacha Baron.
Oh God. I hear so many stories. The old bait and switch, like, you're a star. I want to talk to you about being a star. Let's meet for dinner in this cozy corner table at fucking Katsuwa.
Yeah. Oh like, God, I hate that. I know. I'm aware that I look very different in all my characters too. I did a commercial for like the Oregon Lottery one time, and I did it the way it was supposed to look. It was like mimicking like an Apple commercial.
Yeah.
And I just was wearing like a collared shirt, and I have my hair pulled back, and then I had to dub myself, so I had to go and do ADR, and I showed up to ADR in like my Coachella vibes outfit, looking just like really slutty and hot, with a headband, and I went in. The guy was like, "Oh, hey," he was like, just so you know, you have to dub this like ugly girl. And she's like stupid. And I was like, oh, tell me more. He's like, yeah. She's like, I mean, hopefully we'll be done real fast. I mean, like, you'll do a good job. She's just like, and I was like, and then as we were in there, I finally, like, after a couple takes, I was like, well, when I filmed it on the day, and then he was just like,
oh, shit.
Yeah.
That's awesome, though. As an actor, that's what you want.
Different.
That's what you want to hear.
Yeah, yeah,
people
yeah.
People don't recognize you. That's
I don't
like
want
compliment.
Someone to tell me that my other version is that ugly. But if I was just no makeup, yeah.
That's quite, oh, man. I want to see these videos now.
Yeah,
so when was the first big sort of break that happened with you that you would say where you look at you go, this is it. This is a game changer. This is the thing that I kind of moved to LA for.
Well, I wouldn't say I moved to LA for this ABC show Mixology, but once you book your
I remember
show.
You on Mixology.
Yeah.
Is that where you met Santino?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, he was great on that
we
show.
We were all babies. It's funny. I just moved and I found a photo with all of us. Like I remember like my people telling me, like, it doesn't matter if this goes or not. Like, you're in the system. Like, you can test and test and test. Once you book your network pilot at that time, you're in the system.
Yeah.
Like, you're going to keep working. And I was testing a lot. And then that's the one that I booked and it went. And, but anyways, I found this picture of all of us, like, as kids in, like, 2013. And I looked at it and I was like, literally all of us are working. Like,
yeah,
we're
yeah.
all in the system. Like, that yeah. show lasted a year. Every single person has a career.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, it had a lot of steam coming into the season, I remember. There's a lot of talk about it. Yeah.
Yeah, because it was the Hangover guys mm-hmm. and Larry Charles directed us.
Yeah. Yeah. That's amazing.
Yeah.
So from there, is that where you got to be on Togetherness?
How did I get to? Well, doing Jim Jefferies legit was also very freeing.
Oh,
so I did
yeah.
that. I did that before Mixology. And I mm-hmm. loved that. And I kind of did it like during Mixology illegally, you know?
Yeah.
Know, so like, but people knew me from that. Togetherness was like, I just, you know, had done a lot of good auditions for certain casting directors and mm-hmm. I still wasn't, you know, a lot of times they just want you to be more famous. It's like not
yeah.
necessarily meritocracy, but the Duplasses aren't like that. They will vet the shit out of you. And I improvised, I think in my first audition for like my audition with them, at least 20 minutes, 20, 25 minutes.
And it was all improv.
Yeah. We just, making stuff up for forever. But yeah. by the way, we had that much freedom on the show, too. Like,
yeah.
Amanda and I did a scene drunk and improvised, and it was the greatest thing ever.
Were you actually drunk?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, that's fucking amazing.
I love Amanda. I think she's a wonderful actor, and we didn't talk about it, but our characters were supposed to be contentious, and so we both kind of just, like, avoided meeting each other,
yeah.
you know? And I was, like, so glad that she was doing that, because I wasn't trying to, like, love her to, you know, I knew
yeah,
I
yeah.
would, you know? And so, and then when we got to that scene, she was like, she was breastfeeding at the time too. So she kept having to pump out her like alcohol breast milk, you know? She's like, you want to go get wasted before we do the scene? And I was like, yes. And her character had to be really messy drunk. So
yeah.
I knew like, I can have a couple shots, but it was perfect. I was the amount of drunk that my character should be. And she was sloppy and had to get taken home.
I love that they let you do that.
Oh
too.
Yeah. And it was brilliant. I think that's like for sure, like, an amazing, amazing scene.
Can you see it on YouTube? Is it one of those like scenes you can just see, or you have to watch the whole show?
I don't know. Probably. I think you have to watch the show.
Yeah.
I should pull it out just for myself, because
yeah.
it's like where me and Amanda are like fighting at a party, and she's messy, and she like exposes her boob like in a way where she's trying to like show that she's hot, but she's drunk, and it's weird.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to like be cool, but I'm also drunk, and it's just like, yeah. It's
wow,
really
that's
special.
Really amazing.
Yeah.
So at this point, you're obviously feeling like, man, the wheels are moving, right?
Yeah.
And does it change the way that your team talks to you, the way that the industry treats you? Is all of a sudden like doors open? They're like, oh, this is like a different, I'm not a piece of shit
yeah.
clogging up the 405 right now.
Yeah,
I'm actually
yeah.
part of the system.
It's funny. After Togetherness, I thought that I would get so much because the industry loved it so much.
Loved
it. And the fanciest people, I remember my boyfriend at the time, he was so sweet. He literally made a list of everyone that was tweeting me about it. And it would be
yeah.
like Ryan Johnson, like everyone who was amazing. But I didn't get a lot after that. I didn't have the right team. I've had certain lovely agents and stuff like that. But I don't know. Also, like diversity, it's really tricky to be diverse.
Do you think that's the case now?
Yes, 100%. I literally,
as a white male,
yeah.
let me just say,
I know.
I take umbrage with that comment.
Yeah, well, I get like the optics, and I know that there's more opportunity, but for the first 7 years of my career, there just were not roles.
And sorry, because particularly, and I think it is changing now.
It is changing.
But I feel like there used to be a thing like, you're either this or you're that.
Yeah.
Even if you were ethnic, you had to be this ethnic.
Well, yes. And then once they started hiring ethnic people, they would be like black. And then I'd be like, well, or, still can't audition
for exactly
it. Or exactly
Asian.
This,
or exactly yeah. Mexican.
And I
can't
mixed,
be all of them.
So they're like, what are you? That's why I think usually I end up being like, you know, I'm like the love interest that is also diverse or whatever, you know. But I don't know. I was telling my friend, like, I had sold a show to HBO and then I lost both of my execs. So it died, but they gave it
a
back to me.
A show that you wrote.
Yeah. And so I'm going out with it in turnaround. And even during COVID, after Black Lives Matter, all this stuff, one network was like, oh, we already have an Asian show. And I was like, I'm sorry, what? First of all, this isn't I'm not selling an Asian show.
Yes.
Second of all, I'm sorry, you have one out of this many. Therefore, you can't even like take my pitch during COVID when we're just chilling. And it's not, and I'm like, I have a certain resume as an actor, so it's crazy that you're not like, yeah.
And also like, okay, you don't want an Asian show, then pick one of my other ethnicities
from. Yeah, exactly. And that's, I'm not selling Crazy Rich Asians, which I guess is a Chinese movie. You know, I wasn't doing that. It was about humans,
which is how
I've always viewed myself. But yeah, so, you know, yeah, it's weird. I guess like the diversity element is weird. Like it was always like a struggle. I would say, this is what I'll say about diversity, is that they are screwing us on money. And I have been I give my soul when I'm acting, and I do I perform just as well as anyone I'm with. And I'm very well aware that they also need, like, I win the job, but they also need me because their shows are super white. I'm literally the ethnic girl in a lot of white people's shows.
Yeah.
But then I'm getting paid nothing. Like on Kidding, I net $0.
What?
Yeah.
How's that possible?
Because after my team, and after paying for my clothes for a premiere, which were not expensive, and paying for my clothes for the Golden Globes, which were also not expensive, I didn't make anything.
Yeah, because that's also one of those high prestige things with Michelle Gondry.
Yeah.
Now, Michelle Gondry, he's also
But that doesn't happen anymore, by the way.
What do you mean?
I mean, I just don't let that happen. I just tell her. I just blow it up all the time, and I just won't do it. I was supposed to do more for like a Netflix show, and they weren't paying me, and I was like, bye.
Well, that's a good place to be in. I'll say that.
It's great. But now, it's also like, it has to happen.
Yeah, of course.
Diverse people need to do that.
Yeah,
you know?
Of course. In this town, people are so insecure, and particularly as you get older, you're like, I'll just take a fucking job. I don't give a shit.
Yeah.
And they'll just take whatever the hell it is, you know?
Yeah.
So it's good that you're making a stand like that, and you can.
Yeah.
Do you feel that one of the things that you can do to help what you're talking about is pivoting to writing and directing
and
producing more?
Well, that's the thing. If I had my own show, then, you know, that paves a way, you know. I mean, I always want to create. I always want to be an auteur, you know. And so I have projects that are like that going in the market. But that helps. That helps with the visibility. That makes it so you're definitely going to get paid because you created the thing.
Yeah.
And and it inspires, you know, anyone else that's your ethnicity. Like I booked this pilot for Fox, and it was very specifically Filipino. And it's like they couldn't find, like, who are they going to hire? Who other than me? Truly. No one can name another Filipino actress.
Wait a second. Hold on. Filipino.
Yeah. Name a Filipino actress that's working.
Does Manny Pacquiao count?
Maybe if he was an actor, maybe.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's like, you know, there's only a handful of people to choose from. And then they're like, oh, none of these girls are famous. Like, we had options for like some other roles, and they're like, they're not famous. I'm like, yeah. Because they don't hire my ethnicity.
Yeah, exactly.
I am the person that they've hired.
It's a catch 20.
I snuck through the cracks.
Yeah, it's a catch 22.
Yeah. So, you know, that's the other thing. That's the other thing I will say that has happened with pay and with the long arm of having a lack of diversity is you would get to a certain level and it's like, well, you're not famous. Like Alison Brie, bless her heart, was like, I feel bad for having taken BoJack Horseman because she was playing an Asian and whatever. But I tested for that. And at the time, I couldn't get it because I wasn't as famous as Alison Brie. But I wasn't as famous as Alison Brie because the opportunity literally did not exist. There was no audition for me in Community. There was, you know, that was not an option. So there was no way I could have been as famous as Alison Brie.
Of course.
And therefore been able to play this character that's Asian like I am in voivoiceover, which, by the way, probably paid her at least like $6 million over that many years. You know, I don't have that. Like,
now, don't you think, though, that with everything that's happened this year, in particular this year and during quarantine and Black Lives Matter, everything else, don't you think, and also Me Too, you know, put this all compounded. don't you think this is setting up a unique opportunity for someone like you, who has an incredible body of work and a good voice and ability to create, really unique opportunities you haven't had before?
I would say so. I think maybe more next year. I've just been surprised. Like I said, it was mid-COVID that, like, coming out of HBO is very fancy. So the fact that, like, someone, like, at a major place, streaming place, wouldn't, like, even just let me BS for 30 minutes was, like, you know, and the change happens when people actually, there's societal pressure, and then there's people actually realizing the value, or realizing that something needs to happen, or, like, just getting, you know, I like Parasite. Everybody likes Parasite. Why is Parasite interesting? Well, because it came from a brain of a man that has a completely different experience, but he's talking about stuff that we all kind of relate to. So it's fresh. You know what I mean? And sometimes when you're I always pitch very, you know, brave things. So that's going to be something that people don't necessarily glob onto right away. But if I'm pitching something that's brave and I'm telling them that about an experience that they don't understand, it's hard to connect. And I understand that from trans friends pitching me their show. And I'm like, that's interesting. I literally can't relate. Like, I've had an experience where I went, oh, this is how execs feel when they hear me. You know what I mean? I'm for you. I get you. I literally, like, my soul can't connect right now because I do want to learn and I do want to see a different part of this. But it's like, I'm trying to be like, oh, well, where, like, it's almost like we have nothing in common to the point where I literally, like, I wouldn't know if I were an exec, less now because I've had so much exposure to it and I'm trying to, like, get more audiobooks. But if someone, like, maybe like 2 years, if I was an exec in 2 years ago and a trans person was pitching me their show, I would have had a hard time being like, how can I help you? I would have to be like, yes, you do get absolute control, person whose work I don't know. Because I don't know that world. So I don't know where I could have helped or, you know.
You don't know how you're going to mold that world if it's not your point of view.
And then as an exec, it would have been my job to additionally educate myself. And I don't know that everyone will do that.
Yeah.
You know?
Of course. Now, as you're moving forward with your career, is there, I don't want to say like 5 year, 10 year, but, you know, look, you could run a fucking studio.
Let's do it.
But do you have aspirations like that where you're like, if you look at someone like Issa Rae, like she kind of created her own thing, her own brand, based on a show about herself, but then became much more, became a symbol for something, became a symbol for black women in entertainment.
Yeah.
Do you see yourself as someone who could kind of fall into that sort of space? Because I don't know if you know Dan Kim, Daniel Day Kim.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So he's like an old friend of mine.
Yeah.
But he sort of took the mantle by himself to really represent Asians.
Yeah.
And he became very political about it. And I think that's cool. Is that something that you want to take on? Or does that look like, or are you just kind of worried about what you need to create out there?
Well, no, I do. I would love that. I mean, that's what I've been trying to do in more so, I guess, like the mental health space, which is the narrative behind my show. But I would love to have my own show. I always want to be an auteur. I always want to direct the things that I make. And like, I directed a short film that goes out to people, and that's how I get my meetings. And I know that that's been very helpful to me. But it's funny to even think about that because, like, even like, I have so many gal pals who have their own show, and they see the lack of support for diversity through me because they're going, like, my friend Ashling has her show This Way Up on Hulu and in the UK, and we're like the same, like we're best, and she's just like, oh yeah, and so now and then they'll make your show, and then like she sees like the roadblocks that I have, and she, you know, she just doesn't have them, and I have way more of an acting resume
than,
or at least at the time.
So this is like, but she's in England, they have a different
but she is also but by the way, I went to visit her last month, and when you go to England, you're like, oh, they don't pay their people. they'll pick up the really artistic show, but they're not gonna pay you. Hopefully you can license it to like Hulu or like whatever, but I was like shocked. I was like, oh man, this poor girl. Not Ashling, but this other girl that we were hanging out with, like, this girl should have millions and millions of dollars, and she doesn't. Me and Ashling were like, you are supposed to get this. You have to say this. And the girl's like so overwhelmed.
So the one last thing I want to talk to you about is you've obviously done a lot of self work, and from your past trauma.
Yeah.
And you talked about trauma therapy. Now, is therapy something that you just recommend for all people? Is it something that you feel has changed your work and changed how you approach your work? Is it like, what? Where was the moment where you feel like you had a shift with your mental health space?
Yeah.
Where you could sort of be in the business with a better mindset, you know? Is it something you're still working on?
I never want to... I think every human being has a mental health issue that they can work on, especially post-COVID. Yeah. I just don't think that they know it, and that's bad. I am the type of artist where I'm like, not trying to like beat all of this out of me. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like,
during COVID,
everybody got a trauma.
Everyone's trauma.
Yes.
Some people just aren't aware of it.
Yes.
They don't know what they don't know.
No, they don't know it, and they don't know what a trauma response is. Everything is different, you know? I'm surprised that people don't realize that everyone's going to have like a mental health, you know. I think that this is what was the biggest thing for me. I don't mind any of my stuff. You know, I guess I'm technically bipolar 2, you know.
What does that mean? Because there's bipolar 1, bipolar 2.
Yeah, bipolar 1 means when you're manic, you're most likely breaking from reality, and you are.
Yeah.
You're never not. I don't know if you can be manic and not break from reality. But so for that reason, you need to be on lithium.
Okay.
Otherwise, it's dangerous. You know,
dangerous to yourself and other people.
Yes, you could. I have friends with, bipolar 1, you know, wonderful, like charming brothers, well-educated, and they're homeless by choice because they're, you know, it's a whole thing. And then if you add a substance to that, it's even worse. Kanye, obviously, like, you know, we can see the cycles. But if you're bipolar 2, you get hypomanic and you don't break from reality. And it can be a bunch of things. You could be hypersexual. You could be compulsive, you know, spending. You could be really productive. That's usually what I am. You know, there's like mental health and then there's like personality. You know, I'm a dork. I'm like, it's time to paint my entire apartment in a day. And I do. But that's not the biggest, never been a big problem for me, or I don't consider that a huge issue because I'm aware of it. So I know what's happening when it's happening. Trauma is less manageable, you know? And that's also, I say that like as a person that has read a lot about, you know, what bipolar 2 is. I literally diagnosed myself when I was at Berkeley when I was 15 and having my first hypomanic episode. And then years later, like got that
confirmed. And hypomanic means what?
Hypomanic is like, so when I was at Berkeley, like, all of a sudden for 3 weeks, I didn't need to sleep, like, at all. You don't need sleep. You don't need sleep. You don't need food, usually. And you can just, it's kind of like being, I've never done cocaine, but I would imagine it's like cocaine.
Sure, or meth.
Yeah. And, like, for me, I would go on really long walks at night that were probably dangerous all around Berkeley. But as I was walking, I would be singing and dancing at the same time because I'd be like getting stuff done, you know. And I say that I was like the danger, you know, like there were all these like homeless people that probably could have killed me. But I was the crazy singing, dancing person. So like, what was I on, you know, like this little girl that looks like Blanket Jackson. And then or just like super, you know, for me, it's been like, it's usually like a next level hyper productivity or being really hypersexual and then just like try not to act on it, you know, because that can be really dangerous.
Of course.
And, you know, and I'm aware of like how dangerous that can be. Other people like wouldn't maybe know that that's, you know, so I know like to curb it. For me, it's always been like getting a lot done at once. I would walk at Berkeley. I would walk and take notes in my book while I was walking, but then almost get hit by a car because I'm not paying attention.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's one of those things, like, I hear about that, and part of me goes like, damn, I wish I was a little bit bipolar too, because God, I'd love to be more productive.
Yeah. It goes in waves. And any hypomanic or manic episode, it can be 3 weeks. It can be rapid cycling where you're 6 weeks on, 6 weeks off. It can be 3 years. Like, you can literally be manic.
Whoa.
Yeah. So it's all, you know.
But then the crash happens.
Depression is not good.
And that lasts the same amount of time.
I think so. And it's bleak, you know.
Yeah.
I've had like, I feel for like my ex of 10 years. I'm like, oh man, he definitely was exposed to a lot. But also if you're combining like trauma with that, you're just like, you're just adding like too much. So for me, like, trauma therapy was initially a response to the fact that I was getting sick, and it will affect your health. So, and there's a thing called ACE scores, adverse childhood experiences, and it's a 10 question test. And if you have higher than 3, you're probably going to get an autoimmune disease. You're probably going to get sick. And so my health was like deteriorating. And so I just kept looking for answers for my health. And a lot of it, it was all pointing to like doing like trauma therapy. Wow. And a trauma therapy where you're actually fucking with your brain a little bit and doing some intense type of processing.
Yeah.
Because that can eventually heal the physical. And it can. I hated it. I would never do it ever again. But you're glad you did. I don't know. I literally won't say that. I did it with someone who was not qualified to be doing it with me. And when I eventually went to another therapist, she was like, the only way you should have done that trauma therapy is if you were in a facility living somewhere for at least 2 months. And she's like, wow. The fact that you were doing this and then going to the grocery store the next day is like so dangerous. And it was.
Yeah.
It was like you're reliving everything. Certain types of trauma therapy that have a long lead, you know, I don't know, some people do hypnosis, EMDR stuff, you know, you're being affected for the next year and a half.
Wow.
So you might have the best positive benefit in a year and a half, but it's not done. You do a session, it's not done. The one session you do is cycling through your body.
Wow. For that's a really year and fascinating.
Half. Yeah.
By any metric, Ginger, you're doing great, and you seem great, and you look great. So, man, you whatever the case is, you have trauma, you hide it. We've been talking for a long time, sorry. So I think we should. No, it's amazing. So is there anything? So people can find you. Where can people see your stuff and find you? She is a great, and I never like plug people, but you are a great actress.
Oh, thanks.
You got a great look, and you got like you know. I know this town's fucking stupid, but you're young. I can't wait to see what happens for you. You know, it's a lot
thank
of stuff.
You. Yeah. Well, I'm just like so like tickled by you. It's just like you have such a wonderful brain, and I hope I get to see you do theater one day. Oh my God.
I don't know if I'll ever do theater again, to be honest. I don't know. I would love to. That was my thing. I was one of those like I was like a Christian Bale theater actor. I was like method. I was like when I played Mickey, this is what happened. I played Mickey Mantle on Broadway.
Yes.
And I fucking worked out and I got jacked up and I was like, if I'm gonna fucking put in the pinstripes for a bunch of Yankees fans, I'm gonna look like Mickey Mantle. I'm gonna sound like I might say Oklahoma accent. And it was great. And I had unfortunately the play didn't last that long. And then the next play I did after that was Rudolf Nureyev, who's a gay Russian ballet dancer who dies of AIDS. So I lost
you were like Lion King.
I lost like 30 pounds and I dyed my hair and I just chain smoked and didn't eat fucking food.
The stuff
and
we
I was
do.
Like, if I could do this back to back, I'm done with theater. I did it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Well, I mean, that's so
impressive. Now it's just, like it's just dick jokes for
you. You're
now
a one percenter. Yeah. Very cool. Very cool.
So thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
Like, God, you know, I'd love to have you on again in the future to talk about more of your stuff. You can talk about anything. You have so many facets. So, So we can find you on.
It's all Ginger the Jester is my social media.
Ginger the Jester. Yeah. And you're on YouTube. Do you have
I'm
any
on,
these?
No, I'm just on Instagram and Twitter.
Maybe you got to put some of these old hidden camera pranks up on YouTube.
I had a website for them and I don't know what happened. I had a personal website. I had a website for all the hidden camera stuff. I don't know what happened. GoDaddy did something weird. I'm paying them. I don't know what happened.
Oh, motherfuckers.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks for coming, Ginger.
Thank you.
Have a good day. Bye. Bye-bye.